Welcome to Endo Battery, where we are sharing our endometriosis journey and learning along the way. This podcast is in no way meant to diagnose or give medical advice, but a place where you can gain knowledge and information that can help you to not feel alone as well as become your best advocate. We want to learn with you and support you wherever you are in your journey.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Shelby.
And I'm Alana, and we're Endo Battery.
Charging our life when endo drains us.
Welcome back to Endo Battery. Today, I am joined by not only one legend, but two, because Chelsea is joining me today, as well as Dr. David Redwine, who is the emperor of endometriosis and really getting us on and bow, who is really at the forefront of changing so many lives in the mindset and the education behind endometriosis and excision. So thank you, Dr. Redwine, for joining us today and taking the time just to lend your knowledge to this community. Thank you so much.
My pleasure to be here.
We're very happy you're here. So we had the opportunity to meet you at the Endometriosis Summit in March, and we learned a ton from your presentations and the topics that you discussed and contributed to. So we were really excited to have you today. So
good. I hope you learned some from some other people too.
Oh, we did. We did. We learned. It was information overload, but we loved it. So
yeah, it was a lot of information. It was cool to see the progression of probably where you started in endometriosis to where they are now. Can you give us kind of your historical journey through endometriosis? Because I'm guessing you didn't just wake up one day and say, I want to disprove Samson's theory. You probably had some factors into changing that mindset.
Yes. I first heard about Samson's theory of reflex menstruation as the origin of endometriosis when I was in medical school. And I recall distinctly now that when I heard it, I laughed almost out loud. It sounded preposterous. Okay, fine. Went through medical school, internship. I decided I wanted to go into OBGYN because you could do surgery, you could do medicine, you can do a little bit of pediatrics, you can do, you know, you're treating kind of several different cross specialties. And so that appealed to me. I kind of envisioned myself being a surgeon as I was growing up, and that's what eventually happened. So anyway, I met and married my first wife while in medical school at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. That was in 1970. And she, unbeknownst to her, she had endometriosis. And she was always talking about, you know, pelvic pain throughout the month. And intercourse was painful. And, you know, this was kind of all new to me in a sense. Mm-hmm. When I got out of medical school and going to internship and residency, she continued to have these problems. And so she was seen by a gynecologist, a general gynecologist in Portland, where we were, where I was undergoing training. And eventually she had a laparoscopy and endometriosis was found. And we were told, well, there wasn't very much and we burned it. So she should be fine. Well, she wasn't fine. And so when I got through my training and was going to Bend, Oregon to open up my practice, my wife still had, you know, the same degree of problems. She had been put on birth control pills, which really didn't help. She had also along the way been put on danazol, which really didn't help. And so we went to Bend and I talked with one of my partners about, you know, my wife, that she might have endometriosis still. And everything that a patient with endometriosis encountered along the way. My wife was dismissed. Endometriosis itself was dismissed. It's just endometriosis, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we realized, as many patients with endometriosis realize eventually, that you have to fight to make any forward progress. And so my wife was no better. And so we went to one of my former partners and said, look, we think she needs surgery. She's had birth control pills. She's had danazol. She's had the endometriosis burned at laparoscopy. Can we just cut the disease out? And he kind of went like that and said, what? You want me to, let me get this straight. You want me to remove the disease from the body? And we said, yeah, that's right.
Shocking.
That's right. We want the disease out of the body.
Yeah.
And he said, that's just not done. And I said, well, you know what? Nothing else has worked. Just do it. Mm. And so begrudgingly, he took her to surgery and he had to do a laparotomy, but he cut the disease out. She woke up in the recovery room pain-free. Hmm. I had already been seeing in my own patients a little bit of endometriosis. And so when I saw that my goal to have the disease removed from the body would result in relief of symptoms, which at one level is a very simple connection. I mean, that's what we do in medicine. But at another level, it's the profession is so in control of people who don't know much about endometriosis. I mean, then and now, that there was all this confusion and contradiction and such. So I was able to kind of cut through it with my wife. I saw the results in her. I was seeing the same results in my patients. I remember my first two patients with endometriosis, about 1978, 79, somewhere in there. And I saw the endometriosis, and an article had just come out published by Dr. Hassan about electrocoagulation of endometriosis. And so there was endometriosis kind of all over, and I couldn't burn every place, you know, vigorously, but there was, in each patient, there was a couple of areas in the bottom of the pelvis that were not near any other structure. I could put the electrode on those lesions, put a brick on the foot pedal, leave the operating room, have a cigarette and a beer, return, and then, you know, look in, and with smoke and fire pouring out of the pelvis, you know, I looked at those things and I said, man, that endometriosis is destroyed. I destroyed it by electrocoagulation. Well, silly me, the patients didn't know any better, but to continue to have pain. I took them both back to surgery different months later and looked in, and I expected to see some endometriosis here and there, but the areas that I was positive I had destroyed them, I looked in, it looked like nothing had been done. And it was at that moment I said, well, birth control pills don't work. Danazol doesn't work. Electrocoagulation doesn't work in my hands, even despite, you know, a very aggressive attempt.
Yeah.
The only thing that works is to remove the disease by excision. And so that mindset happened very early in my career. It actually was starting to form before I went into practice. So anyway, I didn't have any special training in endometriosis. I didn't have any special training in laparoscopy. I didn't have any training at all in excision of endometriosis. And, you know, the only thing we learned through the laparoscope in those days was just to look in and look around, or to, you know, do a tubal ligation, burn the tubes, cut them, what have you. So I began to keep track of some very basic things, because I knew that the confusion existed even then. The confusion had to indicate that something was wrong in our understanding. And, you know, the way my wife and I had kind of butted up against the medical establishment, we were seeing a disease that, you know, caused some pain, various varieties of pain. The establishment was saying this is a disease of infertile women, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the reality was different from what the textbooks said and what practitioners were doing. And so that's what I set out to try to find out. I said, well, you know, what's going on here? I had, you know, early in my career also, I was doing laparoscopy and on a patient with pelvic pain, and I saw these little things in the pelvis, kind of almost like speckles of sugar or something. They were kind of whitish, somewhat clear, what have you. So I had one of my partners come in and look at those things through the laparoscope, and I said, what is that? You know, you're the experienced person, I'm the newbie. And he said, well, I don't know what it is, but it's not cancer and it's not endometriosis, so don't worry about it. Okay, thank you very much. And, you know, he left the room. Well, silly me, I wanted to know what these things were. So I kind of timidly did a little biopsy through the laparoscope and sent it to the lab, and lo and behold, it was endometriosis. And it was at that moment that I understood one of the big problems is that for over 100 years, people didn't even know what endometriosis looked like. And everybody looks about, you know, talks about the classic black powder burn lesion, blah, blah, blah. That was it in the old days. So I thought to myself, well, this is crazy. I mean, you know, here's endometriosis that doesn't look like it's supposed to. I wonder if endometriosis behaves like it's supposed to. And in that regard, it brought up Samson's theory of reflex right. menstruation as the origin of endometriosis. You know, I thought to myself, well, how am I going to document the amount of endometriosis in the pelvis? But like the American Society of Reproductive Medicine staging system is very crude. It was yeah. developed primarily for infertile patients, and it just didn't provide any precision. And so what I did is I just simply divided the pelvis up into separate anatomic areas, like, you know, left uterus sacral ligament, right uterus sacral ligament, cul-de-sac, left ovary, left tube, right tube, you know, mm-hmm. and each of those areas had a cell in a database. I also, because of biopsying the stuff that was not supposed to be endometriosis, but turned out to be endometriosis, because of that, I began to keep track of what does most of the endometriosis in this particular patient's pelvis look like. And it's a very crude, you know, looking back on it, it was a very crude type of system. It was almost like, you know, you look in and just glance in and say, okay, most of that looks white. Most of that looks red. It was just kind of a very crude, rough thumbnail sketch of what is the dominant color of the disease in this woman's pelvis. And so I kept track of that also. So I was keeping track of pelvic mapping of where the endometriosis was. Hmm. I was keeping track of what it looked like in terms of, you know, these simple color classification schemes like clear, red, white, black, you know, very, very crude and very subjective. But when I sat down literally at the kitchen table, I had like 125 patients, 130 patients with endometriosis at that point that I'd done pelvic mapping on and kind of see what the pelvis looks like, which I thought was a lot of patients. I ended my career operating on over 3,200 patients with yeah. endometriosis. So 125 seemed like a lot. Right. You know, it was certainly enough to get some kind of an idea about what's going on. So I sat down, and for both the visual appearance scheme that I had, as well as the pelvic mapping scheme, I just divided the patients into 5-year age intervals, you know, from teenager, you know, like 11 to 15, 16 to 20, you know, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. And then I looked at what happened to the number of pelvic areas mm-hmm. as time went by. And I looked at what happened to the visual appearance of the disease as time went by
wow.
in terms of older age groups.
Right.
And so I found that, you know, because one of the things that Samson's theory predicts is that every month it comes out of the tubes and it's going to spread in the pelvis like dandelions. And so older age groups should have more of the disease. Because when you think about it, anything that geographically spreads in the human body, older age groups have more of it and more severe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's facial wrinkles, coronary artery disease, obesity, you name it. If something kind of spreads geographically over time, older age groups will have more of it.
Right.
So anyway, if reflex menstruation were the origin of endometriosis, then with repeated monthly sheddings of the menstrual flow into the pelvis, older age groups should have more widespread disease, more pelvic areas involved. And what I found was is that older age groups did not have more pelvic areas involved. They actually had a little bit less, fewer pelvic areas mm-hmm. involved than teenagers and patients in their 20s. In terms of the visual appearance of endometriosis, I found that when I looked at 5-year age intervals, teenagers had very subtle disease. It could be clear. If you can imagine what those little tapioca grains in tapioca pudding mm-hmm. look like, they look like, you know, little kind of almost grayish ovals.
Right.
Endometriosis can look like that in early stages. And then as the patient population gets older, some of the endometriosis lesions can have a little bit of bleeding occur around it. So some red starts creeping in.
Mm-hmm.
As patients get a little bit older, some of the lesions, not all, depends on things. Some of the lesions will have some scarring developing around or over. And so you get a little bit of yellow or white. And then finally, in the mid-30s, the black lesion was the predominant appearance in my population. And when you go back to the older literature before 1980, the patient populations in the older literature were all between the age of like 30 and 50,
mm-hmm.
which is when the black powder burn lesion predominates. And that's also, you know, by the time patients are in that age group, if they have severe endometriosis, they are going to have a greater likelihood of having surgery and surgical diagnosis. And so what happened is a gigantic process of what's called selection bias occurred in gynecology. people were selecting what patient population to look for, which immediately, you know, biased whatever conclusion they wanted to make. Because if you're looking only for black lesions, you know, the black powder burn lesion,
right,
missing all these others, what it turns out is you're missing most of the endometriosis and you're missing the natural history, you know, from teens onward. So, you know, the visual appearance was important. And if people thought that endometriosis spreads and it doesn't, you know, they're being hoodwinked by something that isn't true.
Dr. Redwine shares with us many slides and illustrations, which you can find on our EndoBattery YouTube page. So head on over to YouTube, search EndoBattery, and you will find the complete episode, including the slides there.
You know, it might be worthwhile at this point to go through reflux menstruation in more detail. The first description of endometriosis was of a chronic benign syndrome of younger females that caused infertility, painful intercourse, severe pain away from menstrual flow, although that pain could increase with the flow. Some of these patients could also have irritable bowel and low back pain. And the signs of endometriosis included uterine retroversion, nodularity of the vagina, cervical stenosis. Some patients could also have low-grade fever and abdominal bloating, so-called endobelly. You can almost kind of see the origins of so-called endobelly here. And the cause in those days was thought to be menstrual retention. Well, the person who first described endometriosis was none other than Hippocrates himself. He is the father of modern medicine. He's also the father of severe endometriosis. Rectal bleeding with a menstrual flow has been seen throughout the ages. Fuking Zhu, Chinese traditional medicine practitioner, had this prescription for it. My guess is that surgery probably works better. Where does endometriosis come from? Well, there's, you know, kind of four main categories of theories of origin: reflux menstruation, hematogenous spread, which means spread through the bloodstream, lymphatic spread, and embryonic. Let's talk about each of these in turn. Reflux menstruation says that normal endometrium refluxes out of the end of the fallopian tube, and then it adheres to the peritoneum, perhaps because of weak immunity, because if a patient is unable to fight off these cells that might allow them to alight and attach and grow. Anyway, here it comes out the end of the tube, it adheres, it proliferates, and it invades, and it becomes the autotransplant that we call endometriosis. And because reflux menstruation can recur monthly, endometriosis can spread throughout the pelvis and it's incurable. So you have to treat it with hormones, hysterectomy, or castration. And by the way, when you consider that how many hundreds of millions of people have had how many hundreds of billions of menstrual flows, this process must be occurring by the billions out there.
Right.
I mean, if 10% of patients with endometriosis get it this way, this is an extremely common occurrence. And it obviously implies dandelion spread. And that would imply that as time passes, more and more reflux menstruation occurs to seed more and more of the pelvis, until finally the pelvis can fill up like a pasture being seeded by dandelions. And this is what a lot of patients with endometriosis think and fear. This thought alone drives some of them to be a little frantic about their situation. Mm-hmm. Well, reflux menstruation predicts there'd be more disease in older age groups of patients. And this is the 5-year age intervals I was talking about earlier. Percent of patients that have endometriosis should increase over time. But in fact, this is what I found with pelvic mapping of the 5 or 6 most commonly involved areas of the pelvis that are most commonly involved by endometriosis. Older age groups seem to have less disease than younger age groups. So where is this dandelion spread? Mm. Philippe Koninckx in Belgium did a similar study and found the same thing.
Okay.
Here's what his graph looked like. Older age groups did not have more surface area of involvement. So, you know, the dandelion spread predicted by reflux menstruation is certainly not revealed by looking at involvement by age groups. And that goes against what should be seen.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But really, what doomed Samson's theory of reflux menstruation is there are 3 missing steps. There's the missing step of peritoneal attachment, mm-hmm. proliferation, and invasion. I mean, steps 1, 2, 3.
Right.
We don't have any proof that these exist. Where is the robust microscopic proof of each of these steps? It's been 100 years. These steps are occurring, as we said, probably by the hundreds of millions or billions. So why aren't our GYN textbooks filled with thousands of photomicrographs documenting each of these steps? We have cartoons like this, and this is a pretty fine cartoon. I made it myself. You see, it's got some shading here on the fallopian tube. You got some shadows on the ovary, and you got little tissue segments of endometrium here in this big blob. But, you know, it's a cartoon, even though it's a nice cartoon. It's
very
a cartoon.
Nice.
And when you think of the immunologic warfare that's supposed to be going on in the pelvis of patients who don't develop endometriosis, remember what is said is, oh, they have reflux menstruation too, but they have competent immune system that are able to fight off the reflux endometrium. And that's why patients with competent, you know, vigorous immune systems don't develop endometriosis. Well, we don't have any evidence that that competent immune system is doing what the people say it's supposed to do, which is, you know, kill reflux cells. So I would expect us to have lots of photomicrographs of that if it were true. But you see, people are just saying things because they've said things for decades and, you know, now a century. They just say the same things over and over again. Let's talk about the menstrual flow itself. This is what a menstrual flow looks like. Over here on the left, you see stroma. That's a tissue fragment of stroma. The stromal cells are kind of compact and dark and not quite round, but somewhat. Over here on the right lower quadrant, you see the glandular cells, the tissue fragment. You see the glandular cells are taller than the stromal cells. And the gland cells surround a gland opening that you can kind of see there between them. Here in the middle, we've got RBCs, red blood cells. And a red blood cell is 8 microns in diameter. And red blood cells are a pretty good measuring ruler for microscopic slides because the size of a red blood cell is pretty darn consistent unless the patient has some kind of anemia. So 8 microns is a good measuring stick. So you can see, just looking at this, that stromal cells look like they're maybe 2 or 3 times bigger than a red blood cell. Over here, the glandular cells, they're pretty tall, so they might be 4, 5, 6 red blood cells, you know, who knows. But if a red blood cell is 8 microns in diameter, a capillary is 10 microns in diameter. And looking at those stromal cells, I'm just saying they're 20 or more microns in diameter. And the glandular cells are 50 microns or more in greatest dimension. So the stromal cells and gland cells are pretty big compared to red blood cells. Now, everybody says, oh my God, this is all microscopic. It can't be seen and it's very difficult to see and all that. Well, consider this. Human hair is 100 microns in diameter. And we can all see a human hair at arm's length, right? Mm-hmm. You know, pluck hair out and hold it. This is a human hair held at arm's length on a microscope slide. And those two little eyes that you see that the arrows are pointing to are the gland stroma complexes of endometriosis. If you look at where the hair touches that gland on the left and imagine that, you know, the glandular cells are kind of around that bottom there, you can almost imagine that you could see an individual glandular cell with your naked eye. You can't quite because, you know, it's just a little bit too small. But what I'm saying is the cells that are involved in reflux menstruation are rather large, actually. They're not small. Okay, one arm of Sampson's theory is a peritoneal circulation arm. And some physicians who are doing pelvic mapping have found that the left uterosacral ligament is involved a little bit more frequently than the right uterosacral ligament. And I found the same thing with my pelvic mapping. Well, people who want to support Sampson's theory invented this peritoneal circulation model or arm of Sampson's theory, whereby the sigmoid colon becomes important in protecting the left lower quadrant from the circulation. So here's what it's supposed to look like. The circulation goes around like this. The sigmoid colon diverts that circulation, so it protects the, we're looking at the patient, you know, the patient is looking at us, so that what looks like the right lower quadrant in the frame is actually the patient's left lower quadrant, so because the sigmoid colon is on the left side of the pelvis. And so the sigmoid colon is supposed to protect the left side of the pelvis from having the menstrual reflux swept away. And so the monthly seeding can accumulate in this sheltered, protected area, and that's why you have more left uterosacral ligament involvement than right. Whereas on the right side, cells that are refluxed from the right tube are swept away to fall wherever they might. Well, where did the peritoneal circulation evidence begin? Where did it come from? A radiologist named Morton Myers studied, I believe it was about 20 men who he did a tilt table exam on them. I'll explain what that is. He had 20 male patients who had abdominal cancer, abdominal ascites, which means fluid in the abdomen. They had abdominal effusions and abdominal abscesses. So now these were male patients. They did not have a uterus.
Right.
They did not have a normal abdomen either, because they had one of these things and they were being studied with a tilt table exam where radio opaque dye was injected into their abdomen. X-rays were taken while the tilt table was moved. And what Myers did is he was able to generate a diagram, just a simple diagram, to show where the dye might go. And basically, it kind of could go anywhere. In his diagram, heavier arrows means kind of more flow. Lighter arrows means lighter flow. But it kind of just went everywhere. So where did the peritoneal circulation arm of Sampson's theory come from Myers' data? Well, here's the Myers original figure from 1970. In 2008, some European authors decided that if they took Myers' figure and if they made 8 separate changes to it by erasing arrows that, you know, went the wrong way and adding arrows, you know, that went the way they thought it should, then by altering Myers' figure, they could create evidence supporting a peritoneal circulation to explain the slightly increased incidence of endometriosis of the left uterosacral ligament versus the right uterosacral ligament. Well, I don't know what to say about this. You know, first of all, Myers wasn't studying female patients.
Right.
You know, he was studying males with severe abdominal catastrophes going on. And then to take that evidence and alter it, the authors did not provide any of their own new evidence. They didn't do their own tilt table exams. They just decided to erase and add arrows as needed to confirm the bias that they already had, which was that Sampson's theory can explain everything.
Yeah, that sounds more like,
you know, the name for this is scientific misconduct. This is scientific misconduct. On the other hand, though, if I use this methodology and if I take Myers' figure and if I erase all the arrows going in the clockwise direction and add arrows going in the counterclockwise direction, I can prove by using the same methodology of this published paper in a peer-reviewed journal, I've shown that a counterclockwise peritoneal circulation actually exists. Well, reflux menstruation would be easy to observe and impossible to miss each step. Supporters of reflux menstruation are either withholding evidence or they have no evidence. Mm-hmm. Neither of those is an acceptable position to be in. I just say, show me the pictures. Mm-hmm. I've seen all the cartoons. I produce cartoons. Again, I like this cartoon because I made it myself. You see, it's got a kind of shady background. It's got the you know, little shadows. It's got the fimbria. You know, I love it. But still, you know, it's just a cartoon.
Right.
You know, this is what is used as scientific evidence to support a variety of treatments of hundreds of millions of patients around the world.
Right. Mm-hmm. And okay, we have the ability to see that. If it was really happening, we have the technology to be able to witness that if it was happening.
Now, wait
correct?
A minute. Wait a minute. You're getting ahead of it.
Okay.
You're getting ahead of things.
Sorry.
But that brings up the question of human visual acuity and the ability of science to image things, basically, right? Mm-hmm. How good can science be at imaging things? It's the COVID virus. Mm-hmm. It's 100 nanometers across. Nano means very, very tiny. And you can even see the spikes on the COVID. Mm-hmm. Something that looks kind of the same, but it's not. This is the Tycho Supernova 1572 remnant. It is 61.7 quadrillion kilometers across. Mm-hmm. So this is just kind of a quick sketch of how good science is at seeing things from the small end of the spectrum to the large end of the spectrum.
Right.
Okay, let's go in the middle of the spectrum here. Somewhere between 20 and 100 microns in size, there is a set of cells that cannot be visualized. And that's why the existence and activity of these cells has to be represented by cartoons. Now, if that doesn't prove Samson's theory, I don't know what does. You know, the point is, it's ridiculous. You know, your question was exactly on target. These cells are not small. These cells should be numerous. This should be occurring by the billions. Mm-hmm. Why do we have no evidence of this? Mm-hmm. Is it because there really is this 20 to 100 micron size that science cannot visualize what happens, you know, with each step? I mean, it's crazy. The evidence would be easy to find. I mean, it'd be a high school science project to prove right. Samson's theory. If what I'm saying to you makes common sense and sounds simple, it's because it is.
Right.
And people are trying to make things very complex because they are trying to hang on to a theory that never worked. It was never, mm-hmm. it was never proven. It was never true. And mm-hmm. when you think about the number of careers, job promotions, you know, that have occurred among academics, perhaps because of work and publication regarding Samson's theory, it's like, what a house of cards.
Right.
So where's the evidence? We don't have any evidence of these missing steps, and it should be easy. You don't even have to look, just go blindfold and take biopsies, you know, in the pelvis. You couldn't miss it. And where is the immunologic warfare against the reflux tissue in females without endometriosis? These are, you know, kind of two important classes of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tell you what, I found the missing steps. See, what happens here is Tinkerbell comes in and she deposits superficial endometriosis on the surface of the peritoneum. That causes superficial endometriosis. And then deep endometriosis is caused when Tinkerbell drags the endometriosis down deep under the peritoneum. What? You're not laughing at Tinkerbell, are you?
No, we love Tinkerbell.
Okay. We're fans of Tinkerbell.
We like
you know.
Tinkerbell. And the Tinkerbell theory makes more sense than,
Well, you see how, I mean, it explains both superficial and deep disease. It's right. a perfect theory.
Right.
But where, I just, again, show me the photomicrographs, show me the pictures.
Right.
Also, remember, we've said that in patients with competent immune systems, they're going to be fighting off the reflux cells. Well, I found missing evidence for destruction of reflux tissue by a competent immune system. What? You're laughing at Pac-Man.
Pac-Man. Again, it makes perfect sense. It makes more sense.
You have no respect.
Probably makes more sense than the free flow.
You're laughing at 100 years of tradition and lore in the gynecology community. Yeah. How does that make you feel? Pretty good?
I feel like a rebel right now.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Reflux menstruation, it is supported only by cartoon evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it a faith-based belief. You mm-hmm. believe on Samson's theory. That makes it a religion. Mm-hmm. And religion doesn't have any place in medicine. It makes people do crazy things for non-medical reasons. And that's why Samson's theory is the most dangerous theory in the history of medicine. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine any more damage done by a theory than this. And the problem is, it is still ongoing.
Yes. Now, can you talk about some of the consequences of it just briefly? I know Alana and I are pretty, I think, familiar, but I think our listeners would love to
consequences
hear
of
Samson's theory. Like, why is it so dangerous?
Well, you believe that it's a problem with reflux menstruation, then you would do whatever you could medically or surgically to stop reflux menstruation, which means you would put the ovaries to sleep. If the ovaries are asleep, you know, the menstrual flow may stop. Or if you remove the uterus, the menstrual flow will stop. Now, of course, with either putting the ovaries asleep or removing the uterus, the question comes up, well, what about all the endometriosis that's already out there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you put the ovaries asleep, it's supposed to just go away. Mm-hmm. Problem with that is that endometriosis can produce its own estrogen in the lesions themselves. Endometriosis doesn't care if the ovaries are around.
Right.
The endometriosis doesn't care if the patient is taking estrogen. Mm-hmm. The endometriosis just doesn't care what you think. So it'll just do what it wants.
What it wants.
So those are the two, you know, tragic consequences that right off the bat of Samson's theory.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we can wipe off Samson's theory. Also, his peritoneal circulation arm, the weak immune system arm in patients who have endometriosis, and immunologic peritoneal warfare going on in patients without endometriosis. And just to make sure that reflux menstruation never rears its head again, I'm going to just scratch it out a little bit more. Okay, what about hematogenous spread? That's through the bloodstream. If you look here at the bottom of the pelvis, this is a kind of a schematic diagram of the body showing the venous return to the heart and lungs as blue and the arterial output from the heart as red. If you start down here, the way hematogenous spread through the bloodstream is thought to occur or supposed to occur is during the menstrual flow with all the bleeding that's going on, some of the blood vessels on the wall of the uterus are open and some of the endometrial cells that are kind of floating around get sucked in to the vein in the wall of the uterus. Okay, so anything that enters a vein anywhere in the body is going to find its way back through the right atrium and the right ventricle and into the lungs. Well, the lung capillaries are 10 microns in diameter. If the veins in the pelvis had cells that are between 20 and 50 to 75 microns in diameter enter those veins, what will those cells do when they go through the lungs? You don't have to be a doctor to understand that these cells are not going to go through capillaries. And so if hematogenous spread occurred, 100% of these reflux cells would be filtered out in the lungs, and there should be a high rate of pulmonary endometriosis, which there's not. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at the arterial side here, with much less than 10% of the cardiac output, why is the pelvic peritoneum and the floor of the pelvis so commonly involved by endometriosis? Why not a high rate of kidney endometriosis with 22% of the cardiac output and so on? So hematogenous spread makes no sense. What about lymphatic spread? Endometriosis has been found in lymph nodes associated with large GI nodules. This is uncommon. It seems to be just a coincidence, a co-developmental process. It doesn't result in any disease that's been defined. And another explanation is possible. So there really is no evidence that endometriosis goes through lymph channels into lymph nodes. So we can get rid of lymphatic spread. Well, you know, and this makes it all pretty easy. We're left with the origin of endometriosis being embryonic. The question becomes, what looks like ravioli and holds the answer to the origin of endometriosis? Would you care?
I know
care
what
to
it is.
Yeah.
The germ layers.
Germ layers. Yeah.
Germ layers. What? Germ layers. Like the ectoderm,
oh,
endoderm. Yes.
The tri-layer embryonic structure.
There we go.
Yeah. Very good. Very
I like
good.
Your ravioli thing, and I actually had it in my notes today because I think it's a really good yeah. way to explain it for people who don't have a medical background to understand.
Yeah, the trilayer embryonic structure. It looks in cross-section like ravioli. Well, all early theories of origin of endometriosis were embryonic. In 1882, Babs found endometriosis inside a fibroid and postulated, this must have been here since birth. In 1900, Opitz postulated that Mullerian mesoblastic threads grow into the connective tissue of the pelvis during embryogenesis, resulting in endometriosis, which turns out to be exactly the correct deduction. As a side note, it's important embryologically to understand that all endometriosis is mesodermal tissue. When you look at the layers of the embryonic structure, the blue layer, the outer layer, is the ectoderm, and it forms the skin and the central nervous system, which consists of the brain and the spinal cord. On the bottom, the yellow endoderm forms the mucosa or inner lining of the intestinal tract and urinary tract. And the mesoderm forms everything else. And Opitz's term of mesoblast is just early developing mesoderm. So most of our bodies are mesoderm, including all endometriosis. Well, in 1908, Clage applied Opitz's theory to deep endometriosis, and really all questions were answered, but plausible genetic support was lacking. So there things kind of sat for a while. In the meantime, in the 1920s, a theory of origin based on cartoons came out. In the 1930s, radiation was used to destroy the ovaries to stop their functioning in patients with endometriosis. In the 1940s, Joe Meigs found that if you remove endometriosis, you could cure it. He did laparotomy excision. In the 1950s, color televisions came into being. In the 1960s, birth control pills were used to treat endometriosis. In the 1970s, electrocoagulation was used to treat endometriosis. In the 1980s, danazol was used to treat endometriosis. In the 1990s, laser vaporization came out, which showed that you can't treat superficial endometriosis with laser vaporization, but you can induce scar tissue and carbon deposition. In the 1990s, also Lupron came out. In the 2000s, robotic surgery was developed, which showed that you could do the same surgeries with equivalent outcomes more slowly and more expensively. And in the 2010s, Oralissa came out, which really is no better than a weak birth control pill. But by that time, the wait was over because the genetic basis of the origin of endometriosis is being unraveled by genome-wide association studies. The building blocks of endometriosis are being revealed by these studies. And if you look across here, just at a sample of some of them that have been found, what's the first thing we find? Embryonic development, you know, angiogenesis, growth of new blood vessels, estrogen response. I mean, all the stuff that you may have read about, you know, that patients with endometriosis experience and lab tests. Here it is at the basic level. We're starting to see where it comes from genetically. So how do you put it all together? Well, you put it all together by looking at everything together. Don't focus only on endometriosis. If you focus only on endometriosis, it's like focusing on only black powder burn lesions. You know, you're going to miss the big picture. Well, the big picture includes the fact that endosalpingiosis is related to endometriosis. Endosalpingiosis is where tissue resembling the lining of the fallopian tube is found outside the pelvis where it doesn't belong. And interestingly, endosalpingiosis can also be a cause of pain. Well, endocervicosis is where cervical tissue is found outside the cervix where it doesn't belong. It's rare. It's uncommon. But it's related because these are all epithelial abnormalities. Then there's the muscular relatives, adenomyosis and fibroids. They're related. And then the structural defects that accompany endometriosis, like cervical stenosis, uterine duplication, absent kidney, double ureter, peritoneal pockets, that's related. And the fact that it occurs in males, that's related. It's almost as if there is some overarching Mullerosis gene ensemble to explain all this stuff. Well, if there is, what would it look like? Well, it would be part of the human genome, and then there'd be everything else that's not in the Mullerosis gene ensemble. And we already have candidate genes that are in there, and every time I pick up a newspaper, I read about a new gene that has been associated with endometriosis. So just throw it in here too, because it'll have to be sorted out later, you know. But just looking at this list of genes, which I'm sure is incomplete because it's been a while since I updated it, you can kind of begin to see the problem faced by geneticists in terms of endometriosis. This is not a simple off-on light switch type gene process. It's much more complex than that. Well, anyway, this gene ensemble results in abnormal differentiation and migration of mesoderm during gastrulation. That's during the embryonic formation. And this leads to all of those yellow tissue defects and structural defects that I just listed. It also can lead to other things like ovulation defects, endometriosis in males, other peritoneal proliferations. And for each of those yellow tissue items that you see there, there are several genetically determined traits, such as where will the endometriosis be? For anatomic location, morphology, what will the endometriosis look like? For histology and activity, what will it look like under the microscope? How active will it seem? Symptom severity, well, that's just how much pain the patient is having and what kind. And malignant potential. So each of those traits is genetically determined for each of the tissue types and can vary from none to severe. And this is the essence of my concept of Mullerosis that I published in 1988. Call it what you want. It's just a genetic / embryonic origin of endometriosis theory. Call it Mullerosis. I don't care. It's genetic and embryonic, and it's not Samson's theory.
Right.
Well, humans have been around for only about 65,000 years. They develop endometriosis. There are several primates that have split off the human clade that develop endometriosis. 25 million years ago, rhesus monkeys split and they develop endometriosis. 340 million years ago, the first mammal appeared. And 500 million years ago, the first Hox genes appeared. And it's as if this Mullerosis gene ensemble has fired an arrow down through several primate clades down to our own human species. So when you look at all the evidence, it's like when you stand back. That's what I mean by don't just look at endometriosis. You stand back and look at everything. It becomes clear that this has a genetic origin. And what comes before that? Well, my God, you know, you go back in time to the cosmic microwave background into the universe. Everything was patterned long ago in utero. At conception, the genetic is loaded in. And as time goes by, on day 12, gastrulation begins to form the mesoderm. And what happens is epiblast cells are converted to the mesoderm through the primitive groove. And this is what it looks like. Those cells are going down and, oh, I'm falling into the mesoderm. And that's gastrulation. So the genetic load that a patient receives from their ancestors is expressed during embryogenesis by formation of abnormal mesoderm. The differentiation and migration of the cells is abnormal and things don't go where they're supposed to. And this is what embryogenesis looks like. It goes from head to tail. And then if you look over here on the right, this is what the genital ridge looks like at 33 days, 37 days, 41 days. And each of those days, there is ingrowth of genetic material from the surface of the genital ridge down into the genital ridge. So you can kind of almost imagine that there's a lot of mixing of cells and genetic material going on here. Mm-hmm. And then that's what results in the deposition of tissue tracts that carry the potential to form endometriosis or may have islands of endometriosis in them already. And you get these gradients. It's a little bit more common near the peritoneal surface than it is down deeper. And deep endometriosis can occur. And what happens is two types of tissue are laid down. You can have so-called embryonic rests of endometriosis. These are small islands that just or actual endometriosis, or you can have stem cells that are occurring gradients nearby the endometriosis. And in the old days, one of the theories of origin was the Solomic metaplasia theory, which just said that any cell in the peritoneum can form endometriosis. And we know that actually is probably true. Not all the cells in the body necessarily have a strong tag to form endometriosis by metaplasia from stem cells. But as you get closer and closer to the pelvis, yes, you know, more and more do. So this process of laying down either endometriosis or stem cells occurs in patterns that are also genetically dictated. One of the interesting things about endometriosis surgery is that after the first 1,000 cases, you realize that you're seeing the same things over and over and over and over again. You're seeing the same distinct patterns throughout the pelvis. It's not a random disease. It follows these patterns. The most obvious pattern is just in the pelvis, because that's the most common area of pelvic involvement. And this just shows the results of my pelvic mapping study showing that the cul-de-sac is the most common area, and you can kind of see around the pelvis in order where the endometriosis occurs. But the bottom of the pelvis is the most common area, because when you look at embryogenesis, the pelvic organs are forming by sliding down across the back of the embryo. They slide down the back and then up to form the uterus, tubes, and ovaries. And so that's just the pathway that the cells are passing through. And so they're most likely to stop there by their genetic tag. And of course, the uterus sacral ligaments can develop deep endometriosis because they have muscular tissue. Hox patterns, Hox genes, are important in the human female pelvis. The Hox genes have specific areas of the pelvis that they are responsible for forming. HOX10 forms the uterus and the kidney, and so it probably has a more important overarching effect on where endometriosis is going to be laid down than others. But again, stay tuned to the genetic station, because this is going to be where the answers will be coming. There are macro patterns in the intestinal tract. The lower rectosigmoid colon is most commonly involved, and the appendix in only 12% of patients, 6% of the cecum, and 15% involvement of the ileum, the small bowel. This is in patients who have endometriosis of the intestinal tract. And over on the right, these are some of the patterns that we see all the time during surgery. You got obliterated cul-de-sac with an associated sigmoid nodule on top. And down here, you got invasive disease of the uterus sacral ligaments and obliteration of the cul-de-sac. And notice how the rectum down here on that lower picture looks kind of rounded, almost like it's got a ping pong ball in it. Mm-hmm. That means that the muscle wall of the bowel is involved by endometriosis. Mm-hmm. There are macro patterns of extrapelvic endometriosis. The right diaphragm is favored 10 to 1 over the left diaphragm. The right mm-hmm. inguinal canal, 10 to 1 over the left inguinal canal. The right sciatic nerve, 2 to 1 over the left. If you look at scar endometriosis by implantation after C-section, let's talk about that a little bit.
Yes, let's talk about that. This is right up my alleyway here.
Okay, at the time of a C-section, the entire wound is seeded by amniotic fluid, blood, and endometrial tissue fragments. You know, it's a mess. And this shows a typical transverse incision used for C-sections most often. And the little red asterisks just or kind of a schematic representation of contamination by amniotic fluid, blood, endometrial tissue. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. The question becomes, well, if you have this contamination everywhere, why isn't there C-section scar endometriosis everywhere? Well, it turns out that scar endometriosis follows its own patterns. It's typically just a single nodule, not nodules peppered all over. It's in typically in a lateral location, rarely in the midline, and it always involves the fascia. And so, you know, the question is, why is that when theoretically lots of little cells are being spilled? Well, you can think of the abdominal wall also as having a macro pattern of endometriosis. It's almost as if, you know, yes, as you're close to the pelvis and in the pelvis, the patterns are strong and numerous. But as you get further and further away from the pelvis, the patterns are more diffuse and weak, so to speak. But what if there's a focal pattern area of the anterior abdominal wall that just needs a little stimulation by the growth factors of surgical healing? Mm-hmm. If there are little genetic tags to form endometriosis from stem cells, that may be all that it takes. But it's always been curious to me why the scar isn't involved from right to left, up from the skin down to the peritoneal cavity, if scar endometriosis incurs by implantation. So there could be a patterned area on the anterior abdominal wall as part of this kind of body-wide genetic patterning of where endometriosis might develop in a particular patient. Well, there's smaller macro patterns of endometriosis, such as on the anti-mesenteric side of the bowel. That means on the side away from the blood vessels. You can see here, you can kind of see the blood vessels are transilluminated. That's the mesenteric side. The anti-mesenteric side is where the endometriosis is. This also occurs on the anti-mesosalpingeal side of the fallopian tube. In other words, on the side away from the blood supply. And there can be fibromuscular metaplasia of deep endometriosis in von Recklinghausen's pattern of muscle tissue. He identified long ago that muscle tissue in the pelvis is where deep endometriosis is going to develop. And that includes the uterosacral ligaments, the round ligaments, and the muscularis of the bladder, bowel, and ureter. Well, here's a micro pattern. This is the first one. This is hidden seating of the colon. And this is the lining of the colon is over here on the left, the colonic mucosa. And then this, most of the, what you see here is the muscle wall. And I've circled two islands of endometriosis that have no communication to the outside. So over here on the right side, it says serosal surface. That's the surface that reflux menstruation would implant on if it were the cause of these circled areas of endometriosis. But you can see that they exist without any apparent relationship to the surface of the bowel. And keep in mind that the colonic mucosa is endoderm. That explains why it is not primarily involved by endometriosis, because endometriosis involves mesoderm. Yes, endometriosis can erode into the colonic mucosa eventually, secondarily, but the endoderm is why colonic mucosa is not a primary site of endometriosis, which is also explains perfectly why most colonoscopies are negative for endometriosis. You know, it's not endoderm tissue, it's mesoderm, so it's on the other side of the mucosa, and you don't see it. Micropattern two is hidden seating of the ovary, known since 1899 by William Russell. And if you look here, you can see it says on microscopic study of the right ovary, we were astonished, absolutely astonished, to find areas which were an exact prototype of uterine glands and interglandular connective tissue, in other words, glands and stroma. So this area right in the middle is like the bowel endometriosis that you saw earlier. It has no communication to the outside surface. This is something that the patient was born with.
That makes a lot more sense as you explain this compared to the other theories.
Micropattern three is just hidden seating in the lymph nodes. It just happens to occur in patients who have large nodules of endometriosis nearby. It's just where endometriosis happened to be laid down in that patient. It happened to be laid down in the lymph node. It didn't come there through the lymph channel, which also is quite small, and it would be unable to pass the typical reflux cells. That's just a micro pattern. Surrounding stem cells, superficial recurrence can be explained by surrounding stem cells following excision. If you look over here on the left, superficial endometriosis represented in the schematic form by the E with kind of a red gradient of stem cells around it. And then you get to an area of no stem cells. So if you come along and in a patient with superficial endometriosis, you excise all the endometriosis, but you don't get all the stem cells, you can have superficial recurrence due to the remaining stem cells, possibly because they're stimulated by the growth factors of surgical healing. Whereas if you come along and remove all the endometriosis plus all the adjacent stem cells, you're going to have local cure. And basically the same thing it can be said for deep endometriosis. There's going to be an area of no stem cells. If a surgery gets into that area, that's why endometriosis can be cured in that area. But superficial recurrence is explained by an embryonic model with stem cells thrown in. What evidence is there of an embryonic origin? Well, in 1988, I found what looks like endometriosis in the cul-de-sac of an infant female that had died of sudden infant death syndrome. This was the first effort by anyone to prove a developmental embryonic type of origin. People talked about it, but I wanted to go back in time as close to the embryo as I could to prove it, so to speak. And so I found this in 1988. Since then, Signorelli really in Italy, he went back even further and collected abortuses and found evidence of fetal endometriosis. And of course, case reports of fetal endometriosis are cropping up, as well as fingertip endometriosis.
That's crazy.
This patient with a fingernail had endometriosis of the fingernail bed, which, as you would guess, is mesoderm.
Right.
So opiates and an embryonic origin explains everything. And the origin of endometriosis is important because if it's laid down embryologically, it should be possible to cure the disease surgically if all the tissue tracts are excised, both endometriosis and surrounding stem cells. You should be able to cure endometriosis surgically. Well, we already knew that back in the 1950s because Joe Meigs said that this was following conservative excision at laparotomy. They didn't do laparoscopy much in those days, but they knew enough in those days to open the abdomen and guess what? Remove disease from the body. And he said, this is the kind of the experience of the time speaking, recurrence is not frequent and cure by conservative surgery is usual. So we've known for 70 years that you can cure endometriosis surgically. I mean, it's not news. Everybody knows it. Everybody says it. And there, look, here we go. These are the published cure rates following excision as judged among reoperated patients. This is not, are you still symptomatic and stuff like that? This is looking in, do you have endometriosis at reoperation or not? And you can see that cure rates ranging between 56 and 100% have been reported. In my study there near the top, I also documented that in patients who did have endometriosis at reoperation, they had less disease than they did at their first surgery. Mm-hmm. So with excision, endometriosis goes from this amount to none or this amount to much less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, surgery is pretty good and it's been known to be pretty good for centuries. Sushruta, a famous Indian physician, said that surgery has the advantage of producing instantaneous effects, hence is the highest in value of all the medical tantras. And Hippocrates, my man, father of deep endometriosis, he said the diseases which medicines cannot cure, excision cures. And you don't want to argue with Hippocrates.
That's right.
But people say it'll just come back. And why do they say that? Well, they say it because of Samson's theory and cartoons. And when you think about it, reflux menstruation predicts failure of all therapies. Okay, so what? You go in and remove it all. It'll just come back. So what? You go in and take the ovaries out and it shrivels up. Well, it's still there. Just the symptoms will just come back. So you go in and, you know, treat with medicines that don't work. Okay, it'll just come back. Reflux menstruation predicts failure of everything, of all therapies. When you realize that medical therapy doesn't treat anything, it perfectly satisfies the predicted failure. Reflux menstruation and medical therapy are kind of in an unholy symbiosis where one can't exist without the other. And the same thing could be said for incomplete surgery, because if you go in and you burn endometriosis on the surface but don't treat the disease, if you excise some of it, but not all of it. Well, reflux menstruation will, you know, get you off the hook when the patient comes back to the office and saying, God, you know, I had about 2 weeks of pain relief after surgery, but then when my pain pills ran out, the same pain is back. Surgeon can say, well, it's due to reflux menstruation. It'll just come back. Excuse me, I've got to go deliver a baby. My nurse will talk to you about Lupron.
Right.
So with reflux menstruation, it's perfect. I mean, you don't have to think. It's automatic. Mm-hmm. It's hopeless.
Yep.
Accept your fate, oh ye women who cannot tolerate a little menstrual pain.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we've got cartoon-induced circular nihilism going on here. It's just crazy. I'll say it again. It's the most dangerous theory in the history of medicine ever. Mm-hmm. We don't need reflux menstruation. Embryology explains it all. People say, well, we need more than one theory because there's all these things. We don't need more than one theory. We need one theory that has more than one mode of action. And hello, the genes provide that.
Right, right.
I mean, there appear to be, if not dozens, hundreds of genes involved.
Right.
And interacting with other genes, turning them off a little bit, turning them on a little bit, turning them off completely, turning them on completely, throw in a little methylation with time, you know, this, that, environment. It's like any manifestation of endometriosis can be explained by genetics. Mm-hmm. You don't need more than one mechanism. Mm-hmm. It explains it all. Well, if the endometriosis is mesoderm and the brain is ectoderm, how does cerebral endometriosis occur? Another way of looking at that would be to ask, how does mesoderm invade the ectoderm? Don't all answer at once. We're going to get back to that. What we need in the future is we need more excisional surgery because it's, as we heard from Hippocrates himself, it's true Hippocratic medicine. And we need more excision for cure. We need it to augment genetic research. We need anatomic site-specific analyses of the genomics, the proteomics, and any other omics that we can figure out. And also, we don't even know what endometriosis secretes. Somebody needs to stick micropipettes into the glands to analyze those secretions. I'm sure the secretions will be different from gland to gland and patient to patient and all that, but we don't even know. My concern about the glandular secretions is that they leach through the tissue away from the gland and destabilize adjacent capillaries, which cause bleeding, and irritate adjacent nerves, which cause pain. Mm-hmm. I liken the glandular secretions to battery acid or lemon juice. And, you know, it's secreted, but then it leaches out away from the endometriosis. Does that occur? I don't know. It sure could. Again, we need to look a little bit more in detail at what it secretes. What else do we need? Well, a new scientific truth doesn't triumph by convincing its opponents, but rather because its opponents eventually die. So that tells you we need more cemeteries. My personal path to an embryonic origin and surgical cure came from these four papers. The first one was my pelvic mapping that I discussed. Older age groups don't have more areas of disease. That told me that Samson was wrong. Age-related evolution and color appearance. If you miss the disease in young patients, but then you repeat a laparoscopy later, you'll say, oh, well, here's some endometriosis, but she didn't have it, you know, back here as a teenager, so Samson must be correct. Instead of you missed it when she was a teenager because it was subtle and you found it here, and so you were a victim of one of the biggest scams of the most dangerous theory in the history of medicine. My third article was endometriosis in an infant, which was proof of concept of an embryonic origin of pattern tracks of endometriosis and adjacent stem cells. And if you remove these pattern tracks, can you cure endometriosis? And I showed that by publication, 32 years ago now. Endometriosis can be cured, perhaps even prevented by removal of those tracks. So really, it's going to come down to, for a physician in front of a patient, do you believe in Samson's theory? And if you don't, when did you stop believing in Samson's theory? I stopped believing in Samson's theory in 1988 and had the genetic embryonic approach ever since. And so I think that makes me the oldest living physician who has been, for the longest period of time, completely opposed to Samson's theory and in favor of a genetic embryonic origin. So I need to be included in any discussion about the origin of endometriosis because I was the first and the longest lasting. Okay, bonus question. How does mesoderm invade the ectoderm? Well, answer is this. Blood vessels have muscle in their walls, and all muscle comes from mesoderm. So since blood vessels are going into the brain, those blood vessels have muscles in their wall, the mesoderm is invading the brain. And so that's how mesoderm gets into ectoderm. It's because it's there. So when you think that some medical fact is new, because I thought, God, in 1988, man, I've kind of put it all together. Just review the old German literature. That's a traditional medical school saying. And what that tells me is that Opus was right and Samson was wrong. And that's the end of that.
So much good information.
So much good information.
That should answer all of your questions about endometriosis.
I think we're experts now.
We
just
are.
Just listening to you, I feel like we get it. We got it. So,
well, does it make sense? It's pretty simple.
Yeah. It is. Well, and especially when you think about the fact that it's been found in cisgender men, that it absolutely makes sense because they're not experiencing retrograde menstruation. They don't have fallopian tubes.
Well, actually, no. Or maybe they do. Let me stop you right there.
Maybe.
Let me stop you right there.
Okay.
Okay, young lady. here's how Samson's theory explains endometriosis in males. A couple's walking along at a naturist colony. You know what that is?
Nudist colony? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Sorry. Are we allowed to say that? Can we say nude? Okay.
They're walking along. The woman is menstruating. Some of the menstrual blood comes out. It splashes on the concrete pavement and splashes up into the male's urethra. He's well endowed. And then it goes up the urethra into the male bladder and prostate. And that, little children, is how reflux menstruation explains endometriosis in males.
I don't want to see the cartoon for that.
Yeah, please don't make a cartoon for that one.
Thanks for that idea.
Great. I know it's going to be in our email later.
Cartoon incoming.
I mean, that
it makes sense, doesn't it?
Makes total sense.
Is that any more ridiculous than cartoons?
Right.
No. Not really. No form of endometriosis is explained by Samson's theory.
Right. Thank you so much, Dr. Redwine, for taking the time to explain that. I think that that is imperative to getting better treatment and knowing who you can get treatment by that will actually treat the endometriosis, not just put a Band-Aid on it. So I think that it's really important for us to understand it, not as the textbooks say.
Yeah. People sometimes ask me, you know, what can we do for the future? How can things change? There are many, many possibilities, but the single most important thing would be to abandon Samson's theory and abandon anybody who ever offered that theory. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't cost any money. Mm-hmm. You know, we just say, we don't believe that anymore. We're going to go down the genetic pathway and see where that goes, because we've been going down this crazy pathway for a century and we just still have cartoons. You know, I do have some of the finer cartoons that I've seen.
I agree.
And more coming hopefully here soon.
They are great.
We do like your cartoons.
Thank you.
Yeah. Some illustration skills there.
Graphic design is your next calling in life.
Yeah.
Well, the Samsons people are calling me.
Yeah, I'm sure
they are.
If they want new evidence.
Job security right there.
Yep.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your time and taking your time to talk about that. We really appreciate that. And we're excited to continue learning what you are learning and answer some more questions along the way, given what you've already put into the work of the genetic component of this. So thank you
so
much.
We're excited to see what else comes from this.
Yes.
So thank you for your work.
It's like, wow, if people would just focus on that, just think of the progress.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll help you shout it from the rooftops here. So,
and Chelsea's really loud. We all know that Chelsea's loud.
I'm pretty loud.
So thank you so much. Till next time, continue advocating for you and for those that you love.